Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, just to set the scene from the start, would choose Tennessee Williams over Nicholas Sparks any day of the week. That should give you some indication of what at least some of us think of Olivia Newman's adaptation of Delia Owens' best-selling novel, Where the Crawdads Sing. Following that discussion, we'll take on another documentary involving the problematic lives of young women, the Netflix true crime documentary, Girl in the Picture. Let's begin this week's show by heading to the marshlands of coastal North Carolina. That's the setting of Where the Crawdads Sing, which tells the story of Kaya, better known as simply the Marsh Girl, played by JoJo Regina as a child, Daisy Edgar Jones as an adult. Raised mostly alone in a quaint, if rustic, remote cabin, Kaya has been deserted by the rest of her family, most painfully by her mother, all who have fled their abusive father, played briefly by Garrett Dillahunt. Spurned by the neighboring town, Kaya is the classic outsider, whose only connection is the friendly black couple who own the local store, then two young men. First a childhood acquaintance named Tate, played as an adult by Taylor John Smith, and then by the less trustworthy Chase, played by Harris Dickinson. When Chase ends up dead, Kaya is, naturally, suspected of murder, leading to a trial scene with David Strathairn playing Kaya's Atticus Finch-like lawyer. Never as gritty as it should be, with little hint of the social and racial unrest that marked the South of the 1950s and early 60s, Where the Crawdads Sing is more of a harlequin romance than anything remotely heartbreaking as, say, Tennessee Williams' classic drama, A Streetcar Named Desire.
Well, I think we should start by talking about the book that this is based on, because Where the Crawdads Sing, I think, it's still on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, this was a publishing phenomenon, one of those books that it seems like everybody at some point was reading, the kind of book that you could get in like the grocery store checkout line. Like, that's how popular it was. And I did not read the book, but Mary Pat, you did read the book, correct? Was the book as boring as the movie is? Because obviously, I mean, this seems like it must have been like a page turner, kind of like an overheated mystery that, you know, you read on the beach or you read on your summer vacation. But the movie is just, I was expecting some kind of momentum to the plot, and it just kind of lays there. So I guess I was wondering, right, if you also thought the book, like, was the book entertaining trash? Was it actually like really good literature?
I don't think it was really good literature, but it did keep your interest. And I think, of course, the book is more nuanced,
sure,
because you're capable of doing that. So I think there are some characters in the film that had more of a minor role in the book. So, for example, in the book, the trial and everything that happens with her being arrested happens much later. So the scene is set about where she lives and sort of the backstory, and it's told by a narrator sort of perspective, an omnipresent perspective. And it basically talks about more about race and sort of racial injustice issues in the book.
Which the movie pretty much ignores.
Yes. Right. So
for
that's,
better or worse, I suppose.
That definitely, they go into that in a lot more detail. The attorney's role is beefed up a lot in the movie, which, of course, I was fine with.
Especially when you have an actor like David Strathairn.
Yeah, I mean, doing a Gregory Peck cosplay.
Exactly.
Right. There were two things that I thought would have been maybe difficult to handle in the film, but I thought were more essential to the book and the way that it flowed. Because here the focus was on her visual art and her doing that. In the book, there was a focus on poetry. There was a woman in the community who had been a poet, and Kaya stumbles upon her work through Tate, who's tutoring her. And he has a love of poetry, but of course that suggests that he's not a guy's guy and so forth. So that was a pretty significant, I think, piece of the book that was ignored. And then there was a scene in the book that I remember vividly that sort of shows her naivete, and it had to do with her getting her period for the first time. And of course, that would have been more difficult to show on the screen. But at the same time, during this time period where we're focusing more on women's bodily functions and so forth, I thought it was a mistake to exclude that.
Well, and this is like a PG-13 multiplex movie.
Well, we had Getting Red already this year.
I guess that's true. I guess going back to what I was saying about this being boring is that Where the Crawdads Sing is this tale of abandonment and betrayal and a woman finding her voice and sex and love and death, and it's all set
and rape and abuse.
And it's all set in the swampy backwoods of, you know, 1950s and 60s North Carolina, and it's a murder mystery and it's a love triangle, and she falls in love with two guys, one who's a cad and one who's, you know, true of heart. And then it's also a courtroom drama, and you've got all of these elements in this big gumbo pot of a movie, and yet it all feels so flat and it doesn't really go anywhere. I was sitting there thinking, okay, when is the story going to kick in gear? Because the characters weren't giving me what much to work with. I mean, you mentioned Nicholas Sparks, Dan, and I don't think you're too far off, because I could see how maybe in the book, which again I have not read, could have gone more into the details of these people's minds and how they related to each other. Because here it just seemed like a few pretty actors on screen. And in fact, the two guys that play the good dude and the bad dude look so alike that I was confused at first.
Yeah.
I thought,
couldn't they
have cast somebody that looked – but that's neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. Daisy Edgar Jones, who I have liked in other stuff. We just reviewed her in a movie called Fresh, where I thought she was really good. She's fine here, and I hope that this movie – serves the same function for her as the 50 Shades of Grey movies did for Dakota Johnson, which is now that she's kind of had her hit based on a best-selling book, she can go off and do more out there interesting work.
Same with
like
the Twilight
Fresh
series
with Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson.
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly.
I hope this is kind of the springboard for her because she's really good. But yeah, I mean, this isn't terrible by any means. I think it's competently made by Olivia Newman, but
it's wrong-headed just, in so many ways. Imagine, all right, I know that the time frame of Where the Crawdads Sing is 1953 to 1969. 1953 is when, you know, we see the young Kaya growing up in this remote cabin.
And basically fending for herself
as everyone
abandons her.
Right. Slowly they all do. And as I say, most painfully, her mom. And then her dad just leaves and she's alone out there. And then it culminates with the trial in 1969. And then there's this epilogue which reveals everything, which is, to me, the best part of the movie, but we aren't going to spoil it, although Nathan figured it out way, way before either of the rest of us. Mary Pat knew because she'd read the book.
Yeah, it was hard for me to sit there knowing what was going to happen.
Imagine if this movie had been made in the 1950s, early 1960s, you would have at least had one character with a rivulet of perspiration running down their face. I mean, these people are in the marsh of North Carolina, and in the summer, it is hot there.
Yeah, there's no
sweat
in this movie.
And there's no
sweat.
There's nothing.
No dirt. It is no grit. It's a soft focus.
Oh, man.
South.
It's
kind of a lie in that
and
way.
And there's no steaminess to it at all. There's no passion. I'm a person who cries at Kodak commercials. I mean, my eyes moist up at anything. I was so dry-eyed throughout this movie. I had to even – Mary Pat had to touch me a couple of times to stop me from chortling. I was laughing near the end.
The little girl at the beginning that plays her as a little kid, I thought that was the most effective part of the film where we sort – and that was where I thought, okay, I think I'm going to get sucked into this story because what travail she's gone through, and obviously we see her – well, we see her in a jail cell on the other side. So I thought, I want to see how she gets from point A to point B. And unfortunately, the stuff that happens in between is just – you're right. The lack of steam is important here. And you talked about what if this movie had been made in the 50s or 60s? What if it had been made in the 70s?
Yeah.
You know, when some of our greatest filmmakers were making these really kind of – gritty murder mysteries or neo-noirs in the Deep South. I mean, not that I'm saying that this needs to be a totally different movie, but I didn't like the movie they made, so I'm fantasizing about what other movie it could have been.
Well, and I think in the book, the chronology was different. And I don't know if making the film in the way that they did was done for purposes they thought of clarity or whatever, but I thought the sort of original way that it was presented, you know, was better. Also, there were you know, there were some things that – so she finds out about the engagement, for example, and I'm not going to say with whom and how and so forth, by observing it more directly. And so the shock that she undergoes seems more significant in the book maybe than it was in the film, where there's a more gradual reveal. Also, I thought that playing to the strengths of the performances, I mean, there are really not a whole lot of known actors in this film. Yeah. I mean, David Strathairn being an exception. And so I really did like the performances by the couple who ran the store. In the book, there was – my recollection is there was a bar that figured more prominently, or a cafe that figured
bar.
More prominently.
Oh, bar. Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
That would
push us into
R-rated territory. Okay.
You know, I was never a real big fan of Otto Preminger, but I remember his movie Hurry Sundown that starred the likes of Faye Dunaway and Michael Caine, and I think Jane Fonda was even in that. And I think, what could he have done with this material?
My favorite Southerner, Otto Preminger. Well, that's the thing, is this movie is just missing a sense of what that time and place was really like. I mean, it's like a Hallmark movie version
it's a
of the South.
Fantasy land
but
version.
It's trying to tell this gritty, violent, torrid story, yep. And those two things just don't mix.
Totally agree. And that was Where the Crawdads Sing. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the Netflix documentary Girl in the Picture. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
We say this often, because it's an important fact about public radio. Everything you count on from us. Trusted news, in-depth features, conversations, music, and culture depends on your support. In moments of challenge, possibility, and progress, public radio is a sound, trusted source of information. And that means your participation is more necessary and powerful than ever. Please help SPR meet these momentous times with your generous support, so we can be there for you today and for generations to come. It's easy and secure. Just click the red donate bar at SpokanePublicRadio.org, fill out a brief form, and emerge a new member. You'll be glad you did whenever you turn on your radio. And thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Olivia Newman's adaptation of the novel Where the Crawdads Sing. Let's now move to the Netflix true crime documentary Girl in the Picture. The picture in question is a portrait of a pretty young woman whose sweet smile gives no evidence of the sad fate she would face, not to mention the harsh life that preceded it. It's a portrait of a young woman who, when her body was discovered in 1990, was identified as 22-year-old Tanya Dawn Hughes. The apparent victim of a hit-and-run, Hughes ends up being the focal point of a twisted murder mystery directed by veteran documentary filmmaker Sky Borgman. And twisted is the perfect word, because as Borgman's film progresses, we discover that not only was Hughes not the young woman we think she is, she's not the girl her friends, those whom Borgman interviews at least, thought she was either. In the end, Girl in the Picture is another trademark Netflix true crime story, the one that delves ever deeper into the bizarre depths into which human minds and actions can sink.
It is going to be difficult to talk about this specific documentary and sort of how it plays out, because it is, I think Dan had suggested during a conversation we had, that it's like those nesting dolls that just when you think you've discovered what's beneath, then there's another layer of happenings that occur.
Or of moral rot underneath another layer.
Yeah, because the story at the core of this is almost incomprehensible. And so I think that what this documentary did well is it sort of presents this perspective on what we think is a sad situation, a hit and run accident. And then we start to discover in Girl in the Picture who she really was. But do we? So we find out the perception that her current friends, exotic dancers, as she was, thought about Tanya. Then we gradually go back into her past and discover what her high school friends and contemporaries thought about her and so forth. And then there is the relationship with the man who is her father. And I think that part of the difficulty here is if we talk too much about the unraveling, then maybe it wouldn't appeal to people because they'd already know what was going to happen. Or maybe the real story would be so, so shocking mm-hmm. that people would be deterred from watching it, which is, I think, you know, would be a common and logical response.
Yeah, I almost feel like we should warn people that it takes about an hour into The Girl in the Picture that it's dark from the beginning, don't get me wrong, but when it becomes really disturbing and upsetting, like, people should be aware that this isn't just a standard who killed this person. Like, it goes into upsetting places of abuse and all that stuff.
So our talking about this sort of begs the question, why do people watch these true crime, or why do they gravitate toward these true crime scenarios to begin with? And I will acknowledge that I am enthralled by many of them and have watched many of them. And I think that women in particular feel it's almost I know Dan watches repeat episodes of Star Trek and so forth. And so there's a familiarity to what happens in these documentaries, not necessarily with this one, but a lot of the true crime genre material. Psychologists have tried to determine why women in particular, people in general, are attracted to this genre that's represented in part by the film we're discussing, Girl in the Picture. And they've come up with all different sorts of theories. Like, you know, women will often say, well, you know, now if I have this information about how this might play out, I can protect myself in some way. I mean, we've always gravitated toward Grimm's fairy tales and you know, dark material and so forth. I think one of the questions for feminists who are watching true crime genres or listening to the podcast is it always focuses on the police procedural aspects of things. And here, quite frankly, the FBI plays a significant role in sort of figuring out what had transpired in this circumstance. And so then the question is, in a time where people are pushing back against mass incarceration and over-policing and so forth, what does it mean for feminists to align themselves mm-hmm. with the carceral state? And so I think that's you know, something that maybe has not been examined sufficiently. I guess my question is, do you think that it was so layered, The Girl in the Picture, that it ultimately was confusing and so forth?
No, I wasn't confused by it, because I think you've both done a good job of explaining the structure of this. I'm as guilty as you are getting sucked into stories like this, some of which feel more exploitative than others. My feeling with this one is that the story is so upsetting, and because in real time, these details became apparent as they went on. Like, the girl in the picture, her past became, I mean, they basically worked backwards to find out who she was when she was born. And so we kind of get that structure here. The issue I have, though, is that a lot of these stories take on the tone and feeling of an Agatha Christie story, you know, this kind of fun, twisty whodunit. You won't believe what happens next. And you kind of forget, like, there were real people involved in this. There was mm-hmm. real murder and abuse involved.
And a child.
And kids. Yes. And I think sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees when it comes to those things. But I also think that, like you said, there's almost this lizard brain gravitation towards stories like this, because we can't believe that something like this could happen, and that something like this could happen in plain view in front of so many people over so many years. And I think maybe we're just struck by the horror of it. There's kind of this queasy making element to all of it, not just in the details of the crime, but in the way that it's being consumed by masses on the world's biggest streaming platform. So I'm of two minds about it, because it's really well done and the story is heartbreaking and fascinating in equal measure. But you do have to wonder, like, why am I watching this? Couldn't I have read a scholarly article or a journalistic take on this instead?
The other thing that happens here, Dan always says, if you want to make a great documentary, you need to find a compelling subject. Mm-hmm. And so what is the subject here? Because the compelling person arguably is Franklin Delano Floyd, who we discover is not who he says he is. But he is so horrific. He's such a terrible moral failure that we end up focusing on the girl in the picture. And that, you know, she's already passed on. So we don't get any of her, really, her own writings, her own perceptions, her own perspective on what transpired.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about, Nathan, that people saw what was going on. In fact, there is a very chilling sequence in one of her high school friends witnesses her being raped at gunpoint.
Yeah.
And she was too afraid to ever tell anybody anything. This seems to be really a kind of a theme in the director Borgman's, hit all his work, because he directed the 2017 film Abducted in Plain Sight, which is right. about another guy who steals
and
a kid.
That, and that, in some respects, was almost more...
That's a wild story, too.
Yeah, it's more wild. Oh, not more shocking, not more horrific, but wilder.
Yeah. Going back to that idea of why are we drawn to this, I mean, you mentioned the current state of podcasts, but I mean, going back even to... And I'm sure you could go further back, but think back to Jack the Ripper at the turn of the 19th century or the turn of the 20th century. And think about when
L.A. Confidential, all of these.
Oh, yeah. All of that
true
stuff.
Crime, Black Dahlia magazines. And...
Go back to when Robert Ford killed Jesse James and toured the country in a play that recreated the crime, and people showed up. Well, I guess you could argue whether it was a crime or not. He was a wanted man in the outlaw days. But I think that we just as a society, as a species, are drawn to these sorts of things. Yeah. The problem, though, is that there are so many of them now. It's become such a maybe not even a cottage industry anymore.
No, it's a big business.
That it does feel a little icky at times. But I mean, if this is your kind of thing and for, you know, watch it for whatever reason you want to, because I think we all have different reasons for it. It's compelling, but it's troubling.
By the way, we can't end this without saying that 22-year-old Tanya Don Hughes was actually 22-year-old Susanna Cervakas. Mm-hmm. That was her name, her actual name. So we're talking about Girl in the Picture. That's who she was. At any rate, that was the Netflix documentary, Girl in the Picture. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Murray Pat Truthart and I discussed Olivia Newman's adaptation of Delia Owens' best-selling novel, Where the Crawdads Sing. I'd like this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the late great playwright Tennessee Williams. All of us are seeking a home. And I don't mean where we were born or where we live now and have things, but where we can do the big things, the right things, where we belong, where we fit. Where we're loved. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.